Welcome to this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Live, the show which ensures that you profit from your time spent here with experts, either through their industry insights, information, or simply learning from them. And today we have Daniel Towson. He is a personal health researcher, founder of Timeline Sciences, and he helps maximize your health and longevity. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's great to be here. It's 10 o'clock in Canada, but I'm stoked to have a conversation here with you.
You're welcome to the show, Daniel. 10 o'clock in Canada, 10:42 a.m. in India. And I'm sure not just in India, but a lot of people across the globe will benefit from what we are going to talk about. We'll be talking about how one can maximize their health and longevity. So, Daniel, help us understand, you know, a bit about you. Who is Daniel Towson, so that people know who they are listening to. I've told them about you, but then I guess what best better than you telling them about yourself?
Yeah, I've had a colorful background. I played water polo for Team Canada when I was 20. I tried to pursue being a doctor, but I asked too many questions, so I went down the science route. And then that got me all the way up to the PhD, and I put that a little bit on pause during the pandemic as I had an influx of clientele. And I've ever since I've just been working as a consultant. And you know, I've branched out and simply shared my expertise that I picked up from the laboratories and working with people. So I spent a lot of time looking at computational biology. You take blood from someone, you get a lot of information in the research sense, and then you have to paste it together, make a puzzle of it, of what's going on. And you know, it's a lot more complicated than anyone cares to admit. And so what's pretty awesome today's day is that biological databases are open access. And if you can understand what they're saying, you can pull a lot of information for yourself. And so now there's, especially in North America, lots of testing people can get. But there's very few people that can help them interpret it or tie it together with other tests that they've gotten from other sources. And that's what I've been doing for about the last 5 years. So I spent some time working for blood testing companies, helping develop some algorithms. But I like the entirety of helping someone's health. You know, just the blood test is one aspect, but you know, there's a holistic approach to it too. And there's still some aspects of our health in which, you know, science is good, but you can't rely on the science because it's lags behind. It's always, you know, years or decades behind. You do have to use your senses, your rationale, your will, your intelligence in order to be able to pull from the science what you can and make the best judgment for yourself, right? Because, you know, the most useful information for you is the N of one for your, you know, for who you are. You know, we have our own unique genome, our own special cases, and we all live different lives. So we shouldn't be doing the same things. We should be doing very different things. So that's a little bit about my background, and you know, happy to share some of the insights that I've picked up over the years.
Absolutely, I'll come to that. So to understand it better, you understand you know, those samples better than other people who are, you know, deriving the understanding either about illness, about anything else. Why is it that you know, blood testing companies, they are not able to look at it the way you look at it, or even doctors are not able to look at it the way you look at it? Is it something, in other words, we can call it a functional medicine sort of an approach? How should we understand it? And you said, is it that, you know, science lags behind? So is it much more extension of science, you can say applied science, where you are actually, you know, helping out, make science better to, you know, come out with better results or understanding about ourselves or our samples?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. So, you know, why is it that doctors don't have this information at hand? It's because there's just too much information. They need, you know, you need to team up and have somebody else do some of the, what I would say, the deep dive into somebody's circumstances. And, you know, your clinics can take about, you know, let's say 3-4 vials of blood, and they can get maybe some liver enzymes, a white blood cell count, you know, the regular iron and red blood cells. But what's available here, at least in North America, and it's becoming cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, is getting a proteomic panel or a metabolomic panel. And that means you don't get just some liver enzymes, you get 150 proteins from the blood or 150 metabolites from the blood. So protein would be like insulin, or it would be like growth hormone, you know, glucagon, all the proteins they can pull, or the metabolites like serotonin, you know, amino acids, acylcarnitine, tons. So not to, you know, so for the people that know what those are, great. For who are those that don't, you know, we can simplify it in ways that, what does that mean for your energy reserves? It's molecules that keep you alive and they're vital. And doctors are only trained so much because, you know, they need clinical tests that are reliable to help them move people through the hospital. But if you're healthy, you know, your doctor's going to tell you to get out of my room. Don't waste my time, right? And come back to me when you have a problem, and then I'll help you. And so this is where then, you know, there is a large portion of the populace that's healthy, but they want to know how they can go about, you know, getting more information themselves. Is what they're doing day to day helpful, in the right track? And the blood can tell you that, because even though the science might not be fully there for you being like, I know exactly what everything means, you do have a way to be able to take out small bits to be able to make predictions. So, you know, for example, if serum albumin is going very high, you know, that could be, you know, in the positive, if you're training very much and you say, okay, I have a good adaptive response. But if your serum albumin is going very high, it could also mean a viral infection. And so this is where you need someone to sit with you and also go through what's going on with you. If I don't get to talk with the person and I just see their data, it's very hard to make conclusions, because your blood is very dynamic. It's not static. Protein can stay static. Some of them is very stable. So if it moves, we know it's a big deal. But some metabolites, they fluctuate throughout the day, you know, and hormones are notorious to fluctuate throughout the day. So often when you want to use hormones for gauging someone's health, it takes more extensive work. And so, you know, the easier it is to measure some of these proteins, the more you can catch in the, you know, a lot at the same time. And you can use technology like a mass spec. But like hormones, they usually need a very specified test. And so this is why, you know, you can't just go in and drain liters of blood from someone to do it. And the technology is coming around so that you can take a vial of blood and get about 150 to 1,000 proteins, depending on, you know, the type of test available. And then who's going to interpret that for you, right? And a lot of that, it's information that's difficult to be able to, you know, translate to people easily. You know, it'd be like clotting factors. Well, what does that mean for me? Well, it tells you about the liver health. It tells you about, you know, the viscosity of blood. It tells you about blood flow. It tells you about circulation. And so it's not a guarantee that every single marker is telling you exactly. But when you have 30 markers all pointing to inflammation, all 30 markers pointing towards a specific organ, you have great confidence to be like, hey, you have nothing to worry about. You know, you can keep going. Or, hey, I know there's no problems from your doctor or these clinical tests, but it does very much so seem like your liver is sluggish. Like it's having a hard time doing what it needs to do because, you know, the value of, you know, the subset of these proteins are low. And so this is the interesting part. But, you know, in a weird way, I've gone through a lot of people's molecular data, and the actions that a person needs to take are very similar, you know, in today's day. So, you know, that's kind of the funny part, is that some of the actions are free and easy to go. It's inexpensive. And that's a big part of what it really means for the longevity aspect of taking care of your health. It's what is it you're doing in a day that does make a big difference, right? Your habits end up defining your character.
Right, Daniel. So whatever data about our blood, other samples we have in our hand, there is much more data hidden behind. And that needs to be understood in the right manner, because that data will actually determine our time on this earth, if we can understand it better. How do you do it? You use some specific tools for it, or you are understanding, correlating one thing to other? How does that work? And who are these people who come to you? What is it that they generally ask you for? I want to understand that actually from the ground level.
Absolutely. So there's two types of really individuals that come see me. People that have no problems with their health, and they're looking to live long and healthy and avoid all the problems. And, you know, they're usually around, you know, 35 to 50 or 55. So I've had a few even 70. And so they just want to stay healthy for as long as possible. And, you know, there's time points in their life where, you know, it's ideal, for example, for them to put a lot of effort in, and then so they can coast for a little longer. Or they've put a lot of effort in, and now they want to know how they can, you know, maintain or coast and not have to continuously keep putting effort. So that's one demographic that comes to me, both male and female. Actually, a lot more females are comfortable and seeking help for their health than males. And then the other side is people that are having extremely difficult time with their health, in which here in North America, you know, the healthcare system failed them in lots of ways. They went from doctor to doctor to doctor, and they're still having problems, and they're not willing to play the game of, you know, guess what drug to take. And so now they're looking for someone like me to help put together a story that makes sense to them, that's incorporating their life experiences, right? And then I think that's a big part to understand that, you know, this person is trying to communicate something to you. You know, there is a timeline where they were okay, and then something bad happened. And so I just use what's available in terms of information science, and I pull from every country that shares their data. And there's databases, for example, the Human Protein Atlas. It's, I believe, out of, is it Sweden or Norway? I'm somewhere in Northern Europe, I believe. They're at least the ones that put the initiative forward, in which it is a database so that any protein that you're interested in, you can punch that in and you can see where in the body it is produced. So that's one easy way just to start the process of bioinformatics. You have a protein, it's only produced in the liver. Really easy. We know then, you know, the liver is something we can support and target. We know things that, you know, as supplements, we know things as foods, we know how the liver functions, we can target it. Something that's a lot harder is something that's produced systemically. So like every single cell produces it. Okay, that doesn't tell us too much. We don't have too much, you know, to go off of, but then we can take a look at, do we know any ways that this protein is interacting, or what stimulates its production? Oh, we do. We know it has a interacting partner. Okay, where does that interacting partner get produced? You know, what's the life cycle of that binding partner? And so the information is present for each of these proteins. It's, you know, sometimes very easy to access. Sometimes it's very hidden, where you have to go to the few papers that people published on. And sometimes they're really old papers and they give you very little bit of information. But this is the part I think it's very important for people to understand. And what I've done for a lot is just translate science. There's a difference between science and story. And I think this is something that I'm very adamant today is what's necessary so humanity doesn't go downhill, right? So we can avoid doomsday. And the only way we do so is by getting smarter, a lot smarter. And so the easiest example I have for science and story, right? If you're in the scientific community, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You get data. And, you know, your team says, we're going to put a story together, you know, to publish it. You have to publish a story, and you only put some of the data in. Not all of it makes it in there. But I think it's an easy way to communicate it, because if we look 100 years ago, somebody discovered and learned about lactic acid, you know. And so for people that don't know, if you exercise and you do activity, your muscles will convert some glucose into lactic acid if you're working at a certain threshold. And so if you work at high intensity, you produce a lot more lactic acid. And the researchers thought, okay, well, you know, they're fatiguing, they're getting sore, lactic acid is causing this. That was their conclusion. But we know that from now, decades and centuries later, that's not right. But so what's the science still present there? Well, the science I can still use today that's very useful is, where did they get the lactic acid from? Oh, okay, they just got it directly from the blood. They even just got it from the tissue. So they sampled both blood and tissue. So that's science. It's where they got it. What was the concentration? Okay, the concentration was a specific value. I can take that value and compare it to populations around the world or today's population. Did that value change in any way? And that tells us whether there is, you know, a big shift in our metabolism from, you know, 100 years, but there isn't, you know, it's still a human being. And so that's the science. That's the science that we use as foundations to build. The story is fine. You know, we have to have a way to communicate it. And I think it's very important for people to understand that is part of, I would say, the communication of science. But it's not the science that is the foundation that sets the ground that will still be useful 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now. And so this is where the science keeps building. And good quality science lays the foundation for future generations.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Daniel. When science, you know, is taken up by the market, then everything changes. And a lot of people then use it to tell the story that benefits them. That yes. Other day, 2 days, 3 days back, I just shared something on LinkedIn. It was some story that I read in one of the US portals. And it said about, you know, 70% plus clinics, all these things were, you know, owned by, you can say, businesses, you know, and not individual clinics, because They are also finding it difficult, unlike in the earlier days, where they could have much more closer look at your health and you will get better. So if everything gets much more, you know, marketed, then the health, perhaps, you know, every individual have to become much more cautious, understand about their health, and not just go to a doctor with closed eyes, but with much more open eyes. And maybe you won't do much of Google about your health, but at least you should know, you know, more about the data that your markers or anything helps. And then people like you who can come into the picture. So let's understand this health thing. What about your, you talked about your having, you know, throughout early years, asthma, allergies, gastrointestinal challenges. With your understanding of all this data better, have you been able to, you know, at least get rid out of it, or at least better managed all these things?
I absolutely have. So I've had a lot of health challenges throughout my life, and I've never been in better shape than I am today. And the information was always present in front of me. It's just very hard to sift through it when you don't have a strong compass, or I would say you didn't develop an ability to have a way to evaluate information. And so this is why I didn't end up going down the doctor route, is because I can't stop asking questions, and I probably would spend, I'd be the worst doctor. I would spend all my time with one patient. I wouldn't see anybody else. Right. So, I managed to slowly go from one problem to the next. So I used to have tons of allergies. I used to be allergic to pollen, to cats, to dogs, nothing anymore. No issue. Springtime, no problems. I have a dog. I can hug my dog, rub my face, and, you know, my dog, not in a single issue. And I used to, before, it would be inflammation and puffing out. And so, you know, the biggest part is to understand, I guess, that is to be able to use yourself as the example, right? Like, first is get curious about what it means to be human, the patterns, the behaviors, emotions, stresses, the physiology, and then use yourself to be able to navigate what is really going on. And I don't take, I would say, you know, I went to the doctor and they told me I have an allergy and, you know, that's it. But I don't take that stuff really to heart. You know, like, you do have to define what an allergy is. And I can see when, you know, if you know how to ask the right question, you can see whether the person in front of you has good credentials or not, you know, and they know how to be able to communicate it. And so I think the understanding of what to ask is critical. And I, from all those issues, have come to a very simple understanding where, you know, about 70% of our health comes from the gut. So if your colon is having issues, you're going to have a lot of problems with your health. That's about 70% of all issues come from the gut. And then now when I did really a deep dive, I do enjoy seeing what all the different parts of the world offer in terms of understanding for health. So when I came to that conclusion, then I realized, wait a minute, this is the same thing that the Chinese, ancient Chinese, this is the same thing as India and Ayurveda. This is even what ancient Greek had. Ancient Greek had, you take laxatives, you drink a bunch of water, and if you survive the majority of the time, you know, you're free of your ailments. And so, absolutely, it was a long, you know, journey for me. And I think it was part of my, you know, so I kept staying curious and hungry to learn more information. You know, I think that's why, you know, like, you know, I had the issues that I did. The complications with the gut, you know, complications with the allergies, complications with my immune system. You know, I pushed my body, I used to, at least in my younger years, way more than I should have. And I would pay the price. And I haven't been sick in about 7 years. You know, I haven't had a cold, a cough, or a sneeze. And it's pretty easy. I think it feels good when you're living life without any problems, right? And I wish that for everyone else. Now, obviously, there's a way to, you know, there's sacrifices. I don't partake in a lot of the modern day, you know, easy access to call it, you know, the sugary, or the, you know, the low quality foods. But, you know, when you free yourself from those things, there, once you have it again, it doesn't have the same satisfaction. It makes you nauseous very quickly. And so that's, you know, that's like the obvious one, in which a lot of people, they don't need me to tell them that, they know it, but there's still this process of not implying, implementing knowledge, almost as if there's a barrier, as if, you know, hey, this isn't the problem. But, you know, those are small ways to optimize, but we can maybe dive deeper into some of the more direct or, you know, big pillars around the health and longevity.
Absolutely. And talking of longevity, does good health also mean, you know, a long life, or is it, you know, are they same things or different things? How should we understand? Because we say people are very healthy, and suddenly some they are no more. Suddenly something happens. So where does that health part, and people who have been not so well, but they live for many, many years. Help us understand this sort of a irony, or help us understand from your understanding.
Well, the way I can summarize it, or at least approach it, is obviously there's something happening here. So let's maybe consider it in two ideas. One is the cellular aspect. We are a cellular being. So there's about 30 to 70 trillion cells that make up a human being, right? My background is cell biology. That's my favorite topic. And so if the cell is good and it can keep going, meaning you've done what you needed to do to keep the DNA in good integrity, that the protein machinery around that DNA can work and do its function, and the signaling isn't too bad. It means you can go really off the, you know, signals that are causing lots of problems, but so long as the protein machinery has to do the function, isn't getting shifted too much, that cell can survive for a really long time. And so obviously for every animal model, from worm to mouse to dog to, you know, everything that we've looked at, if you incorporate time-restricted eating, so it eats and then doesn't eat for 8 hours, then it eats, then it doesn't eat for 16 hours, every single animal model lives longer, including the human. And what that means for the cell is it gives it a break. It's not like constantly saying you need to process nutrients, and that processing of nutrients causes an issue of leakiness across the proteins, and that eventually leaks down and damages the DNA. And so you can see that in every animal model, every animal model and in the petri dish. So on a cellular aspect, if you're doing a great job, then you can live for, you know, 80 years, 90 years, 100 years. And then all the cells are working together to give functions. So you get a lung function, the heart, the liver, you know, the brain. And so there is the cellular aspect and then the physiological correspondent. And this is where someone that's very healthy, that has, you know, for example, good cells, can have a stroke, can have a heart attack, is because they can push their system at the wrong time and they can have some problems. And so even though they might appear very healthy, where they look, you know, strong and fit and all of a sudden, you know, a stroke or cardiovascular event, it's often because that person did have good health at one point in time. They have had a dip somewhere. Maybe they've had a few too many nights where, you know, years, for example, in a stressful scenario where they didn't take care of, you know, how they slept. They ate late. They might have been decent food, but maybe they over consumed, you know, let's say a particular carbohydrate or sweet or some kind of substance that had difficulty processing with their genetics, with their, you know, chemical makeup, with their blood type. And what happens is the liver takes a long time, you know, and it slows down. The blood becomes thicker. And all of a sudden, even though the cells are good, they're not working in as good of a harmony. And then you have an event. You have an unfortunate event that takes the life sooner. And so this is the two aspects that we can maybe, you know, take and examine to rectify those particular scenarios of how come someone can live till, you know, 90, 100 and they don't look so good, while someone, you know, looks great, but, you know, their life ends, you know, in the 70s or 80s. So I think those two parts cover our ways to approach it and apply what we know.
Right, Daniel. Right. So let's look at the five pillars of longevity that you talk about. How should we understand? That will give us a better understanding of this thing called longevity.
Yeah, absolutely. So the most, I think the biggest, the pillar has the most impact is going to be sleep. So people that go to sleep at a reasonable time, you know, 9, 10 o'clock, and then wake up early with the sun, you know, they fare a lot better. And you can see that even one night of poor sleep will impair your glucose metabolism and the way your body uses energy. And then the people that take a nap in the day, but 10, 20, you know, 20 short naps, they also seem to do quite well in the long term. And that makes a lot of sense. So if your recovery mechanism for you to be able to recover every single day is disrupted, then you'd expect a lot of problems a lot sooner. The next pillar is it's not even nutrition, it's fasting. And so fasting, I know in North America here, it's a very big fad called intermittent fasting. And I think that's just called default living. Like the way that human being must live is it must live very respectfully, because when we eat, it's a process that gets turned on, hormonal cascade, and it's an effort to pull in. But when you're okay and you're comfortable, and you're not eating, your body can interconvert the resources it needs. Your blood has a lot of amino acids to build proteins. It has tons of energy. Your fat stores have energy. Liver has tons of glycogen. You can go for a long time without consuming food. The body has, you can consider it a certain strength. And there's a resilience to the fact that you're not hungry all the time that you're needing to eat. There's it's almost like a handicap. Hey, stop. I can't do, you know, this task, or I can't keep snowboarding and having fun. I got to go eat, right? Like, no one wants to be in that scenario to miss out on good scenarios. And so the fasting is absolutely pivotal for every culture that's made it to what I would say the centurions. And so I've taken this information from groups around the planet, and not necessarily the blue zones, even though they do end up, because, you know, centurions can come out in lots of different, areas from Africa, from, you know, there's an interesting valley in Afghanistan, even in India, there's actually quite a few scenarios where the centurions, they eat very, very modestly. They eat, absolutely, for example, rice and lentils, and then 50 spices. So I won't comment on that because that's a little more complexity. But it's a very simple diet, and there is a lot of fasting within, you know, those particular types of cultures, where it's either one meal a day or one very small, very low insulin spiking meal, whether it's no insulin spiking, and then a bigger meal. But it's a very easy for the system. And then that goes to show across the boat. So that number two is fasting. Number three, and it might be challenging in India, but cold exposure. So, you know, the mountain folks ends up, you know, doing quite a bit better with, you know, the easy access to the cold. And they do seem to have quite the robust stimulus from it. So cold is a stressor that the body gets to rise up, and it's a challenge and a beneficial one when the body's okay. So difference always between acute and chronic. So long-term exposure versus, hey, here's a stress and your body overcomes it. And human being is the only animal that I know of, and I've looked at the model organisms only, because that's the available data, right? It's on the model organisms, the mouse, and so on and so forth. And the human, when it's exposed to cold, it is almost every single cell that can participate in moving energy through the furnace of the cell, the mitochondria. And so because you can shift out energy from the mitochondria, you can relieve if you've had too many calories and you need to move energy out. Whereas, for example, in the mouse, that ability to use cold as a heat, to be able to use the furnace to generate heat, is restricted to only some tissues, for example, the fat and parts of the muscle. So cold, very, very important. And likewise, it's going to be the hot. So same way that cold has an effect on the body has to rise in a challenge. The heat does too, but it does a different response. And so there's a subset of proteins called heat shock proteins that when the body's, you know, in a heat stress, for example, the sauna, and your heart rate elevates and you calm it down, your body has undergone a stress and it actually has become more resilient. And really you can see that on the blood vessel elasticity. So blood vessels become a lot more functional. And long-term wise, that's fantastic. So, you know, the third pillar is really what I would say thermotherapy, right? The exposure to hot, the exposure to cold. And you don't need to be a hero. You just need to go in there and at whatever level you're at. So if you're doing cold for the first time, 30 seconds. Next time, 35. You don't need to go 15 minutes. I've had some people go numb and try to play hero. That's not necessary, right? We work with where you're at, your level. The fourth pillar, And I think this one's easy to remember, because if you can remember just a tiny little bit of alcohol, it has a very positive effect on the body. And I know this is going to be very contentious because people have a hard time with dosages. And, you know, across the planet, there's issues with alcohol. I know in North America, terrible. And I think every culture struggles a little bit with the abuse and alcohol. But when you have just a tiny bit, it ends up acting like a digestive. It helps with digestion, but also causes the blood to stimulate. And so when we take a look at the enzyme that breaks alcohol down, the enzyme is present 20% in the central nervous system, 80% in the liver. So you don't want your central nervous system metabolizing the alcohol. You want the liver metabolizing the alcohol. But think of the fourth pillar not necessarily as alcohol. Think of it as digestion. You know, this is the tie-in where, you know, I think the reason why those 50 spices end up being so beneficial is because cumin, for example, facilitates digestion. And digestion is taxing. It's an expensive process for every organism. You have to produce enzymes. You dump those enzymes out, and it's not equal recuperation for it. So this is, again, how it ties in with fasting. This is the fourth pillar. It's digestion, and it's this idea of there are things that you can take And the dosage is extremely important. This is where the homeopathy comes in, come into play, where it helps to stimulate movement and energy throughout the body. So cayenne pepper is another one that has this stimulating effect in the blood. So that would be pillar number four. And then pillar number five, it's very easy to remember, it's laughter. And the takeaway there is it's mood and temperament is the fifth a pillar. And maybe the best way to explain it is it's individuals who are religious without the religion. I don't know if that would be an okay way to say it but
perfect.
You can see across every centurion that I've both gotten to talk to, and that's, you know, I've seen their interviews, they're very thankful. You know, they have lots of gratitude, and you know, they incorporate some type of prayer, you know, to, you know, call it, you know, the universe, the grand intelligence, you know, whatever it is that, you know, we're calling this happening that's happening around us, and it's for life. And they're very difficult people to bamboozle or shake or co-opt or get hooked. They're quite stable individuals. You know, they're not people pleasers either. And so, but they're easy to partake in emotions, and they're not, you know, repressing any emotions. They're full of ability to generate joy around them, right? And this is where they're laughing a lot, right? Both men and women that end up there, you can see that they're looking to make jokes at people's expense for a good scenario. And so this is where I think something that it's very difficult for modern day saints to get, because these momentary, you know, when you have a feeling, for example, you know, someone skins their knee in front of you. I know I get a visceral feeling right at the solar plexus, right in my gut. You know, and I know not everyone gets that, but you know, you have these very fleeting sensations, and that means that there is some type of chemical neural signaling that's happening there, and we don't walk around with a laboratory following us to be able to catch that. And so we do see that how important emotions play in some circumstances with disease in particular. So in cancer, individuals that don't put the onus on themselves but are constantly looking outward are more likely to be the ones to develop cancer, even with like not such a bad lifestyle. You know, for example, a doctor gets the bad news that he has cancer, and his first thought right away is his patients. You know, and that's just the idea. The energy is always going outward. It's almost neglecting to take time for themselves to be able to put the emphasis that they're deserving. They're, you know, necessity to be okay. They take time to, you know, fill their, you know, needs and wants, and in order for them to be able to then partake in the environment. And so this is where mood and temperament is very difficult to be able to pinpoint, but it seems to keep coming up as to, you know, the secret sauce as to the centurions. And so if you can see that those are the five pillars, you don't have nutrition or exercise in it, because, you know, when you're looking at these individuals that make it to 100 years old, they're normally always doing something. You know, there, and a walking is enough. Now, obviously, if you go and you do resistance training, which I heavily advocate for, doing resistance training in different parts of your life to build up a muscle mass, to build up a structure, it's a higher quality of life. But walking has been enough for some of them. And the nutrition has been, it's so long as it is fulfilling the necessity of nutrients that the human body needs, the vitamins, the minerals, the cofactors, so long as those are adequate. It can be a very modest nutritional one. That's why the nutrition and exercise don't even make the top five. As to when you start trying to separate out, you know, the people that make it to 100. Now, the people that aren't making it to 100, you know, you can see they're doing things wrong. They're eating too many carbonated, refined, artificial, processed. You know, those are the other kind of things that start coming into the statistics when you want to examine why haven't they made it to 100, which is a little harder to do. But those are the five pillars, and it's not my insights. It's what I've been able to pull also from the researchers that have done the nitty gritty and put forward the information for me to evaluate. So I do have a lot of people to thank in that regard.
Wonderful, Daniel. You have put a lot of wisdom, lot of understanding of science, lot of understanding of our body, a lot of understanding of our blood. And I'm sure a lot of people would like to understand more about themselves through you, about you, and also perhaps engage with you professionally. So what is the best way for them to do so, Daniel?
The best way is, I mean, you can find me on my website. It's Timeline Sciences. That's sciences plural and very simple. We have one timeline we're all a part of, and science is what we use to describe that timeline. So timelinesciences.com. you can contact me from there, or I am active right now on Twitter. I'm building it up. And if you shoot me a message from Twitter, say, hey, I saw you at the KJ Masterclass podcast, and I'd be happy to engage with you and take you on a journey that you're interested in. So there you go. That would be the best way to get a hold of me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All I can say is, if you want to increase your lifeline, connect with people at Timeline Sciences.
I love it.
With this, it's a wrap on this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Live. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.